Hi, Calvin.
Hi, Oda.
There, I see that you have a wonderful collection of gadgets, gizmos, and specifically Tetrions on the table. And we are doing these sessions on Tetrionics. And today, I had asked you if you would be able to talk a bit about what happens when one Tetrion has been formed in the universe, and how then one Tetrion can interact with others, and how that one Tetrion will interact with energy fields. And in a way, I see that you already have the answer there.
Yeah.
But I might need some help to understand it, if you will.
I just need to explain it, of course. No, that's fine. I mean, like, well, what I'll cover today is you hear me harping on quite often about differentiating mass from matter, etc. And then you always hear these terms, mass, energy, momentum, and the mass energy of a particle, and photons are mass energy or massless particles, even worse. So I thought today, because you spoke last night about trying to fully comprehend all these sort of aspects and how they relate to tetrions and tetrions in motion, etc., I thought what I'd do is go through using these models, which I supplied you with the templates there for. So anyone that listens to this, you can always get in touch with us or look at the Science of Life website and download these particular templates, where you can print them out just like I've done here, and then make them, like I keep encouraging people to do, because it's not until you physically sit down and make the models like we've done here that you begin to wrap your head around some of the finer aspects of quantum theory, and in particular differentiating mass from energy from matter, compared to how we're taught. I mean, like, I was in the same boat as everyone else. I mean, like, I've struggled with some concepts here that I now take for granted. But in trying to communicate them in 2D illustrations, you have two problems. One is the 2D illustration obviously doesn't do justice to something like this, where it's a 3D model. And secondly, there's not enough space on a page to write down all the things that are subtly different to how physics is taught. So in having said that, we'll dive right in here. You can see I've got a lot of models there, as Otto mentioned. But we'll start off with the basics. And the basics are obviously that, so far as tetrionics is concerned, it's a geometric reinterpretation of quantum mechanics. And it's all wrapped around these two things, just the Planck quanta. So when you hold, you print out the templates and you cut out these triangles. You need to realize that, just as in these templates here, a positive on one side — it's a bit hard to see in that camera, I think, because of the light glare — a positive on one side of the triangle has a negative on the other side. So even though you're probably printing out single-paged illustrations with just either a plus or a minus on one page, one side of the page, bear in mind that everything we do here, there is an opposite charge hidden from view. So until you flip over that triangle and see that it's a negative charge, or flip a negative over to find a positive, this information is normally hidden. I'm doing up templates at the moment where you can print out double-sided pages like I've done here, but you can see, as I've done here, they don't always line up by virtue of the way printers grab the piece of paper. It's never in exactly the same spot. But having said that, once you understand that in tetrionics we define any mass energy, and particularly energy momenta, as a geometric shape, i.e. a triangle, we can use that triangle to build the rest of all the fields, all the electromagnetic fields, bosons, photons. And we can also use those bosons and photons to make 3D particles of matter, what I call tetrions. hence the name tetrionic theory. Now, the tetrions don't show up in your standard textbooks because the particle physicists in the standard model don't realize that it needs to be there, which is where these partial charges come from quarks. Quarks as 1/3, 2/3 partial charges are in fact 4 and 8 quantum charges, with the base tetrion, or the building block of matter, the tetrahedral, hence the name tetrion, having a charge of either +4, -4, or it's neutral, because it's made up of 4 charged fields. Now, those charged fields, again, because they're made up of bosons, Planck quanta, equilateral triangles, those fields themselves are equilateral geometries. Now, in the textbooks, or in the tetrionic textbooks, you'll see that I've defined bosons, which are charge carriers, as H nu, or HV, depending on how you want to pronounce it, but it's nu is the proper pronunciation because it's a Greek letter for number. Where you have a odd number of triangles side by side, you end up with a charge, because obviously the pairs, plus and minus pairs, even numbers, cancel each other out, and if you've got an odd number, there must be one charge left over, which will make the rest of them either a plus or a minus charge. And these are the W bosons you hear so much of in physics, in quantum physics in particular. The photons, again, they're even numbered, H nu. So if you see an odd number, as in Planck's formula for quantum is N H nu, as in any number of Planck quanta equals the energy of a particle or a field. And we have to differentiate between particles and fields as well, which we'll do here. But Planck's basic formula, N equals H nu, for the energy of a system, is redefined in tetrionics to show that where N is concerned, as in the number of Planck quantum or quanta, if the total number in the system under measurement is an odd number, then it has a charge, because the evens will cancel out, leaving you with an excess, either positive or negative charge. So if it's an odd number, by virtue of the fact that it's odd, there's an odd number of these triangles, you will have an odd charge, either a positive or negative charge in that field. If NH nu is an even number, then they form together either as Z bosons or as photons. And we all know that photons are neutral particles of electromagnetic energy, mass energy momenta, just like bosons are. But the difference with the photons is that they are dual boson systems. They're a diamond shape, two bosons together. Remember, odd number quanta, of which one is an odd number, can combine to make even numbers. So two odd numbers, two ones, equals two. So two bosons equals a photon. 2H nu equals HF, which is a mathematical formula that the mathematicians muck up continuously in quantum mechanics. H nu equals energy equals HF is wrong. It's equivalent to saying odds equals evens, or one equals two. You can see the difference in the models we make here. One triangle, or two triangles, are needed to form a photon geometry. So you have to start thinking in terms of what the geometry is showing us and what is physically possible to be done with these triangles. And that's all we're doing. There's no rocket science. There's no complex formulas. There's no hidden dimensions. All we're doing is exactly what nature does, and that is takes these triangles, a whole bunch of them, with different charges, and puts them together, or lets them interact. It doesn't even do anything with them. The particles, by virtue of their electric and magnetic fields, will spontaneously interact with each other to form larger, more complex fields, and even larger and material particles, matter. So now that we have our bosons, which are equilateral fields or odd-numbered quanta, and our photons, diamond-shaped fields or even-number quanta, we can start to make these larger-scale fields first off. Now, in tetrionics, you'll see in all the particles, I keep talking about the charge fascia of our particle. For example, tetrions like this one have four charged fascia. They're 4π topologies. Now, the textbooks have 4π topologies peppered throughout them, but they assume, the mathematicians and the scientists assume, that the 4π in these equations relates to a spherical topology. It doesn't. What tetrionics shows is that with the Planck quanta being equal, these 4π topologies are in fact tetrahedral topologies, not spherical. And it's these tetrahedral topologies with their charged fascia that give us all these physical properties that the Large Hadron Collider is searching for at the moment, the Higgs boson, for example, and the mass energies of each particle, which is what this discussion's about. How does it do that? Quite simply, as I said, a countless number of triangles, Planck quanta, are fed into a region of space, i.e. energy is discharged into a region of space, and over time that energy interacts with itself via its electric and magnetic fields within that triangle geometry to create either larger triangular geometries or even diamond geometries, as well as interacting further in a secondary stage to create matter particles, these tetrions. Why haven't we heard of these tetrions? Well, we haven't heard of them because the accelerator experiments that they use to collide the particles together to get all these byproduct or decay particles, measure the decay particles in their detectors via their mass charge ratios. I won't go into that here, but that's what they're doing. They're measuring the charge of the particle, how it bends in a magnetic field, and the mass, how much inertia, or how much energy it takes to slow the particle down, which is shown up as a curved track. So in the magnetic field of the detectors, when the particles collide and shatter, they release additional particles and bosons and photons and tetrions and quarks, etc. They release all them, and then judging by the track, the path they make, how much it bends, what direction it bends, and how long the particle exists for until it either vanishes or is absorbed, they can determine, based on those properties, the mass charge ratio, what that particle is. Unfortunately for the standard model and the results to date, a tetrion, which is either a plus or minus 4 charge, quantum charge, not elementary, which is 1/3 of the elementary charge, 4 or 12 divided by 4 is 1/3. So these tetrions have a plus, minus, or neutral charge, and that plus, minus, or neutral charge, or the charge ratio, happens to coincide exactly with that of electrons and bottom quarks. So in amongst all their collider results and the data they get from it, these particles are there, they're in the data sets, but because of the way we measure and detect these particles, we can't differentiate between a tetrion and an electron, or a tetrion and a positron. Plus tetrion equals a positron. Negative tetrion is the same as an electron. Or with extra mass energies, the negative tetrion could also be mistaken for a bottom quark as well. So in the existing data set, because of virtue of the way we measure things, we've got proof of tetrionics sitting there, but we can't differentiate between them. We can't tell whether one's an electron or a negative tetrion. There is a way, and it comes down to the inertia of the particle itself. But even then, as I say, there are cases where that mass energy of the tetrion will match that of an electron. Because of virtue of the fact that in order to do these experiments, we accelerate the particles. We add mass energies to their chem fields, and that in turn increases the mass energies that are detected, increasing, making tetrions easily able to be exactly the same as that of an electron or a positron or a quark. So how does this occur? Well, quite simply, or as simply as I can put it here, you can see, or maybe you can, if that recording still works and it's clear, I've got a number of, we spoke about the quanta, the Planck quanta, the equilateral triangle, that we combine countless numbers of. When they combine, an equilateral triangle, or a number of equilateral triangles, when it combines to create a field, will create a self-similar equilateral field of quanta. And it just so happens, and this is one of the founding postulates of tetrionics, that those equilateral fields always contain a squared number of triangles. So build them yourself. When you start adding all these triangles together to form a larger equilateral field, you find that you always have to use a squared number. The other thing that comes out of combining these quanta to make these squared number fields, or these equilateral fields, is that even though there's a squared number within that field, there's never an equal number of plus and minus charges. Even if the squared number is an even number, thinking, which implies that if you just divide it by 2, you could have, say, 36. You'd think that you could have 18 negatives, 18 positive charges within the triangle. But the way the charges distribute in that triangle, you quickly find that that's not the case. There's always a an asymmetry between the number of positive and negative charges within any equilateral field geometry. And that asymmetry is what's often referred to in physics as the broken symmetry of charge parity, where the number of particles or quanta ends up either being positive or negative. And there doesn't seem to be a rationale as to what's causing this positive or negative flip. But what's determining whether a field should be a positive field or a negative field, or what determines whether a particle should be positive or negative charge, matter or antimatter? It's unexplained in the standard model, because the standard model is built around this idea that 4π topologies are spheres. So there's no bias, there's no asymmetry possible in a spherical geometry, which also presents problems for special relativity. And that's why, in fact, special relativity was developed, to explain where magnetic moments come from in moving particles. But these equilateral fields with squared number quanta either come in an equilateral geometry, or if you have two of them back to back, you'd have a diamond geometry, just like the photon. Again, two bosons equals a photon. Two electrostatic fields equals an EM field. So again, it's the geometry giving us the answers. We're not having to make up the math. The math flows from it and gets corrected by the geometry. Where the mistakes exist in mathematics, I've taken great care to point out those mistakes and those errors, and show how they should be corrected, or how the equation should be modified to meet the rigid grammar that these geometries provide the mathematics. So these equilateral fields can either propagate in two ways. They radiate out from their sources, either as an electrostatic field, i.e. being zapped by static electricity, or they radiate out as electromagnetic fields, i.e. EM waves, photons, etc. Again, normal rule of thumb in tetrionics is that bosons are electrostatic fields. They have charge, whereas photons are electromagnetic fields, and they have neutral charge. They still have a charge, a plus and a minus, which is what the sine wave that we trace presents us. They're not neutral per se. They have a net neutral charge, but they are still comprised of plus and minus charges and north and south magnetic dipoles. The bosons are, as I said, equilateral fields. The photons are a diamond or rhombic shaped fields by virtue of their geometries. Again, any flat piece of paper, any geometry that's made using these sheets of paper and these templates that's flat, i.e. only has an X and a Y component, and we won't get into the semantics about whether paper has a thickness or not. For the argument, for the purpose of this discussion, think of it as a boundary layer. It has a X and a Y component, and on the other side of the boundary layer, we have an opposite charge, a mirror image. Where we have the equilateral geometries, the planar geometries, they're bosons, and they're always an odd number, with one exception. And the one exception to that rule is this field here, the equilateral field with a squared number of quanta. Now we can, we'll shortly discuss how we measure those, the quanta within this equilateral or squared field. But an equilateral field with a squared number of quanta is, in fact, a Higgs boson. The mystical boson that CERN has been chasing forever and a day, spending upwards of over $10 billion, and they think they may have found it. That's what it is. What role does the Higgs boson play in physics? It's, and here we go with the terminology again, they call it the particle that gives inertial mass to matter. Well, firstly, we've just already said that the Higgs boson is a planar geometry. It's not a particle, it's a field. And specifically, it's a charged field. Now, we've had discussions on in Science of Life before about the electromagnetic properties of these bosons, the Planck quanta, and that these triangles that of Planck triangles that make everything up can in fact be viewed as inductive or quantum inductive loops that are short-circuited. They're a loop of energy running round and round through a coil, same electrical procedure. Where we see inductive mass, it relates directly in physics to inertial mass. So instead of saying the Higgs boson is the particle that gives inertial mass to matter, and explaining it in terms of a soup via the Higgs mechanism, what tetrionics now shows us is that if you have an equilateral field with plus and minus charges, there'll be an asymmetry to the distribution of those charges, and we'll see that very shortly. And the squared number of quanta will always be found on each side of a tetrion. So every tetrion's charged fascia is either plus or minus. The charged fascias are never neutral. There's never an equal number of pluses and minuses. There's always an odd number. Even within the even squared numbers, there's an asymmetry in the distribution and the number of plus and minus charges. So every charged fascia on a matter, and here's the next important word, topology. Now, a topology, hang on, I'll just complete that other sentence. Each and every charged fascia on a matter topology is a Higgs boson. So while they're saying, okay, we found the Higgs boson, and they think it's a particle, but we know it's now a field, we now know that the Higgs boson lines up with the tetrionic quantum charge numbers. That is to say, a tetrion is made up of four quantum charges, or four Higgs bosons. You can use the terms interchangeably. For ages, I just called them charged fascia. But based on the physics definitions, etc., and because they have a squared number of quanta in there, in each face, you can call these charged fascias Higgs bosons. I don't tend to, because it just adds confusion when you're reading about bosons, Higgs bosons, photons. Easier to just call it a charged fascia. They call it a Higgs boson because they went off to theorize what would give matter inertial mass, what gives it that property. We know what gives it that property. It's the charged fascia full of these plus and minus quantum, or Planck quanta. Each Planck quanta is an inductive loop. The inductive loop will resist changes to its energy levels. If you add energy to a short-circuited inductive loop, it will fight. It will resist you adding energy. It will eventually accept the energy, but it resists it. There's an inertial mass, or the equivalent inductive mass in electrical engineering terms. If you go to get rid of the energy out of the circuit, draw energy out, the coil will put more energy back into the circuit. It will collapse the magnetic field that's created, and that collapse of the magnetic field adds energy back into the loop. So eventually the magnetic field collapses so far that it can't add energy, and then the inductive loop has no more energy to give. So it does change, but it reacts just like inertial mass, except in this case, it's inductive mass. And that's how tetrionics explains the inductive mass energies of matter. Each of these charged fascia, plus and minus, has a whole heap of smaller Planck quanta within it. Either, again, plus or minus charges. And it's those tiny, tiny loops of inductors that creates inertial mass. When the particle tries to move through the vacuum energies of the ether, which relativity got rid of, only for Einstein to say, well, perhaps I really need it in the latter parts of his life. And in fact, if you look at the Higgs boson, you'll find, even though the majority of physicists these days say there is no ether, relativity did away with it, you'll find a thing called a Higgs mechanism. The Higgs mechanism is how the Higgs boson creates inertial properties. It does it by interacting with the energies in space. It's the ether. It's, instead of describing the ether, all the physicists and mathematicians did was to say, we'll pretend the ether isn't there, but we'll give the particle we'll give it inertial or admittance or impedance characteristics as though it was moving through some energy field or some sort of substance. But they go out of their way not to say ether, because the paper would have been rejected and stone cold dead before anyone would have ever seen the paper, and they wouldn't be chasing the Higgs boson now. But in order to explain inertial mass, they need that. If you ask them what the Higgs boson is now, to draw you a picture or to explain how it makes it, you get these lovely descriptions of celebrities moving through crowds, etc. That's not a very technical or scientific way of explaining the actual dynamics of a particle. Tetrionics, on the other hand, says quantum inductive loops are the triangles, or the triangles are the quantum inductive loops, and a squared number of them in every charged fascia of a matter topology is what creates the inertial mass of a particle. And what makes it inertial? As you go to move that particle by applying a force, etc., you apply the force, the particle then begins to move inside the vacuum energies of space. There is an ether. It is the vacuum energies. It's the radiated mass energies of the stars, the photons, the bosons, that have been emitted and continued to expand out until they fill space with a very, very weak but extremely significant amount of energy. And just like a fish trying to move through water, particles have to move through those energies, those fields. When they try to move through those fields, the inductive loops of each and every Planck quanta reacts, and they react at differing angles depending on the topology of the particle. Here we have a tetrion, four sides. If it moves, you may have one side only that's bearing the brunt of the interaction. Think of it as moving it through water. One side might be exposed and wear the brunt of the inertial reaction. Or you may point it with the apex of the tetrahedra moving through, and it moves through easily. Equally, here I've got a deuteron, the proton and a neutron. That has 72 charged fascia, some of which are expressed outward, some are internalized. So they will all react varyingly to the vacuum energies, but react they will. They must react because they're all quantum inductive loops, many, many of them. The typical charged fascia, or Higgs boson, one charged fascia of a particle, has 1 by 10 to the 19 of these Planck triangles in it. So 1 by 10 to the 19 is the number of inductive loops that any one charged fascia in matter has. Now that varies depending on how heavy the particle is, etc., and the actual topology of the particle. Element 120, for example, has over a million charged fascia within it. So it's heavier, it has more inductive mass. Now to the net, I'll cap off this quick introduction by saying the definition of a topology in tetrionics, we've discussed the geometry, a planar flat sheet, or a surface boundary, if you like, if you want to get specific and argue about Z components. The sheet of paper, which most people will equate to X and Y coordinates with no Z, is a geometry. Masses and energies are geometries, as are bosons and photons. So if you see the word geometry anywhere in tetrionics, think EM fields, electromagnetic fields. They can be triangular, they can be rhombic, they can be hexahedral. They can be all sorts of shapes, so long as they're flat, X and Y only, planar geometries, or Euclidean geometries is another way to term it. When you have these planar geometries, you'll find that they can interact in a way through their electromagnetic charges that they, and the word is poor here, they don't fold per se, they interact edge to edge. The edge interactions along the magnetic dipoles, which is the first interaction in the fields between quanta, is what we term the weak force. And the weak force is what allows a flat field geometry, a planar geometry, to interact between four or more fields, or four or more Higgs bosons. In doing so, it forms a closed volume. It's no longer a flat sheet. It no longer slices through the vacuum energies. But as you see here in the paper I'm holding, the large equilateral triangle can be folded into four smaller triangles that interact via these magnetic dipoles, the weak force, and they create a topology. Now, as I said, the definition of a topology is a closed volume. It has volume. It displaces a region of space. It shuts that region of space off that's inside of it from the outside world. There's no gaps or holes to allow anything from the outside to enter the inside. And in fact, in tetrionics, you'll find that I term the internal spaces of particles null spaces, to so that they're completely understood to be nothing to do with outside spaces. They're not different, they're just devoid of energy. Even though there may be energy when this particle forms, once it's formed, that energy inside, because it's radiant mass energies, will continue to expand over time and become incorporated into the sides, or the Higgs bosons that form the sides of the particle. In doing that, you're left with a volume, a null space inside that is null. There is nothing in there. And it plays an extremely important role in gravity. In fact, it's responsible for gravity. And gravity only exists when you have a matter topology. The mass energy content of a particle does not affect its ability to create gravity. The gravity is a direct result of the closed volume topology. Once mass energies have interacted in a particular way to form a volume, a 3D volume, we have no longer a mass energy geometry, we have a 2D mass energy geometry, we have a 3D matter particle, a topology. And they're the words that I use to clearly differentiate between mass, energy, and matter in tetrionics. Now, the fields haven't changed, the mass energy hasn't changed when we create these particles. What's happened is the mass energy that would have normally radiated out through space, like a sheet of paper in a hurricane, suddenly ends up like a ball. And that ball has different characteristics to the sheet of paper. When you try to collapse or crush that topology, you find that it is extremely hard, because a tetrion, a tetrahedral shape, is one of the strongest shapes possible. Extremely hard to collapse, even though it's made up of something like mass energy. And don't get me wrong, mass energy can be extremely strong and extremely powerful, particularly in matter, because it's a high concentration. A tetrion, 4 by 10 to the 19 Planck quanta, each one of them can exert a force over a distance. Each one of them has an electric and a magnetic field. And even in this matter topology arrangement, those radiant fields are still moving at the speed of light. They're still circulating around in that topology to give it the solid shape. Just like this aluminium tetrion is very much solid, so are the pieces of matter in our universe made up of tetrions, even though they're mass energy. Now, when we look at these, and we'll go back to Higgs bosons for this next bit of the discussion. When we look at the charged fascia of all the matter particles, and remember, as I said, they are made up of squared number, a squared number of Planck quanta with an imbalance in the number of quanta, an asymmetry, which is where the charge comes from. If there was a equal number of plus and minuses within the squared number, we would have no charges on our particles. They wouldn't form atoms. They wouldn't form chemicals and life. So these charges are extremely important, because once you have two tetrions formed with four or more charged fascia, four or more Higgs bosons, the next interaction after the weak force that formed the particles is for the particles themselves, based on their net charges, say plus four, we'll say in this case to highlight a point, say there were two neutral particles that were created, two neutral tetrions. Those neutral particles, even though they are neutral, would still be attracted to each other, because they still have two positive and two negative charge fascia, or two negative and two positive charge Higgs bosons. Those Higgs bosons, those charges, will either attract or repel the particles until opposite charges bring the particles together. And when they come together, they'll join together to form a new topology. But where they join together, face to face, where the faces are parallel, sticking together like two sheets of glass with a bit of water between them, is my favourite analogy. Those two parallel Higgs bosons form the strong force. They interact via opposite charge attraction, and they bind together. Because the two sheets, the two charges, charge surfaces are parallel to each other and exactly the same size, that attraction is extremely tough. If you've ever grabbed two magnets, you can put them side by side and pull them apart easily. Stick them together so the faces touch, it's a different prospect pulling them apart. That's exactly what happens in atoms. These identical but opposite charged Higgs boson fascia come together and join. And that's what you do when you make the models of quarks. You'll get three tetrions and you'll join them together, usually with two neutrals and a negative in between, which is a down quark, or with two positives with a neutral in the center, which is an up quark, or combinations thereof. They're all listed in the books. But each and every one of these charged fascia, these Higgs bosons that make up these particles, have an equilateral number of quanta. Now we can read or measure or describe the arrangement of Planck quanta within that equilateral Higgs field, Higgs boson I should say, because Higgs field's different, in a number of ways. In tetrionics, I color-coded it. And the color-coding follows the spectral colors, red, orange, yellow, green, aqua, blue, indigo, violet. I added aqua instead of blue because it's very close to light blue and it's a different letter. So there again, I've changed the normal spectrum design. But there's eight primary colors, then there's black, then brown, brown being zero. In the illustrations here, if you can see them, you'll see that in this one, there are 10 levels. Red, orange, yellow, green, aqua, blue, indigo, violet, black, and brown. Brown being zero, or 10, or 20. And the pattern just keeps repeating. We do the same thing for the musical scales. We do it for tetrions and subatomic particles and quantum fields. By color coding the particles, or in this case, the bosons, we can start to see something appearing. And what we see is that each level, you can see how the charge, the Higgs boson is divided into 10 levels, and each level is color-coded. But when you make these models and print out the sheets, you'll see that each color-coded level is an odd number of Planck quanta. So the red one has one, the orange has three, the yellow has five, the green has seven. So you have this pattern, and that relates back to other illustrations in that set, which I'll talk about shortly. But what that shows is that where you have an odd number of quanta in a line, we are in fact measuring the transverse quantum levels. Or another way to say it is that transverse energy momenta, or mass energy momenta, is a boson within that field. So if you see, again, bosons or odd numbers, think transverse quantum levels. So odd H nu equals a quantum level. And that becomes extremely important when we talk about changing the energy of chem fields to produce spectral lines. That's why these colors are the way they are. Because as you release the bosons for the specific energy levels to go from, say, energy level 3 to 4, you have to release the bosons, the five bosons, in energy level 3 to drop down. Releasing those five those five bosons emits a yellow light. The boson is the spectral line that's being emitted by the photoelectron. And that's why the photoelectric effect works the way it does. Because in order to increase from energy level 3 to 4, you need exactly 7 bosons, not 6, not 5, not 8, not 9. You need 7, no more, no less. 7 is the only number of bosons that is acceptable to go from energy level 3 to 4. You can't use, if you want the 7 and you had 8, you can't use, fill up, you'd have 8 in a line and it wouldn't fit into that spot. It's like a key in a lock. The specific boson that's required to jump from energy level 3 to 4 is 5 Planck quanta wide in a transverse section. So that they're 5 bosons side by side. And it doesn't really matter if they're plus or minus in the W boson arrangement. It does, depending on the field you want to create. But in reality, whether it's a plus or minus W boson makes no difference. It's specifically looking for the number of Planck quanta in that boson to fit into that position. Now, once you've added that 5, you could have 5 million other green bosons of 5 quanta each, and they will not work because the next thing, now that you've filled that spot, it needs 7, then 9, then 11, then 13, then 15, then 17. Note, they're all odd numbers. So that also explains part of the photoelectric effect. You need a specific frequency of light or number of quanta in order to fill that position to make the transition. But once you've filled that position, no amount of extra photons shined at that field will make it jump to the next level. Because you've used up the 5, you only needed one of them. It wants 7 now, or it wants 9. And it is in that particular sequence that's what creates the photoelectric effect. And that was a breakthrough for Einstein. That's what won him the Nobel Prize, but it was never fully explained in geometric terms like this. So now we've covered inertial mass. We've covered differentiating between mass and matter. I'll cover one other thing before we cover differentiating energy from mass. And that is, we've just said if we measure a Higgs boson from side to side, left to right, we measure odd numbers. And again, if you get a pen and paper out or a calculator and you add 1 to 3, you get 4, a squared number. 1 to 3 to and 5 together, you get 9, a squared number. 1 plus 3 plus 5 plus 7, 16, a squared number. So you can see, as per the illustrations and the rest of this that I've sent, down what Tetrionics does is down the left-hand side apex of the triangle, I list odd numbers to represent the number of quanta in each quantum level. When you add those odd number quantums or bosons together, you get a scalar energy, the equilateral geometry. Even if you only add 1 plus 3 plus 5 together to get a yellow or a N3 energy level, you still have an equilateral geometry. It's still a squared geometry or a geometry with squared number of quanta. So 1 plus 3 plus 5 is 9. So the series addition of odd-numbered bosons, or odd-numbered Planck quanta, I should say, in bosons within any field creates a equilateral field with a squared number of quanta. That's measuring left to right. Without changing the charge or the Higgs boson in any way or the number of quanta within it, we can measure that field in another way. Instead of left to right, we can measure it top to bottom, as we've done here in the other illustration that you'll see in that paperwork, in those models. by measuring it top to right, top to bottom, a whole new pattern emerges that explains other properties of electromagnetic fields. Now, the number of quanta, instead of being odd numbers, like they were left to right, suddenly form a what's called a normal or Gaussian distribution. That's a distribution of numbers where it's a sequence, integer sequence of numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, up to some number, let's say 6. Once it reaches 6, the sequence then reverses and goes 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. In this case, because we have 10 quantum levels and charge fields are symmetrical in every direction, so believe it or not, 10 across by 10 up is still 10 squared, even though it's an equilateral geometry, not a squared geometry. Looking from bottom to top, you can then count the bosons, or the equilateral triangles, that still remain in this field, in which case I've color-coded them. The red for number 1, orange for 2, yellow for 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 in the middle, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, counting back out. Now that changes, that distribution changes, or the numbers change, for depending on the number of quanta in the field. But it's always this normal distribution, which is another word for it, is a bell curve. It's this distribution of energy and momenta within the field where the most energy momenta is in the center, in that pink arrow, which coincidentally is the linear momentum. The square root of scalar energy is its linear momentum. In this case, we have a scalar energy field with 100 Planck quanta in it. Square root of 100 is 10. As I counted before in the normal distribution, 10 falls in the center of the normal distribution at the peak. That's where the energy momenta is highest. And that follows the equilateral geometry. We draw it as a curve. Mathematicians draw it as a curve. I refuse to. Now I draw it as an equilateral triangle, because that's how quantum mechanics builds it. We measure it as a curve because we're trying to measure something extremely small, and we round off our results on the graph. We don't draw a straight line between the dots. We just smooth it off, giving us a bell curve, when in fact what we're measuring is an equilateral geometry whose square root linear momenta of 10 quanta, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, is highlighted in pink in this triangle. That square root or median bisector in pink, the linear momentum, is what the energy creates. So we have a scalar field of energy, 100 Planck quanta, E equals 10 H nu, where the square root of the energy is the square root of H nu. So square root of 100 is 10 H nu, which is what I've just shown. The fact that they all line up in this triangular geometry means that the linear momentum points in the direction of motion. So that pink arrow always points in the direction of force. You can turn the triangle 120 degrees, and now it's pointing over to the left. That's the direction the force will act in. That's the direction that all the electromagnetic fields propagate in. So the Higgs boson itself is an electromagnetic field. It wants to radiate out into free space. Once the field interacts in the way it has to interact, to form the matter topology, that field still radiates as though it's in free space at the speed of light. But as it tries to radiate out in a straight line, you can see what's happening here. We have four Higgs bosons, or four scalar field, charged scalar fields. The linear momentum radiates out along this to this apex, which is where the magnetic field is, the magnetic dipole. The magnetic dipole takes that energy, builds up an electromagnetic field and radiates it at 90 degrees. They radiate out to where? Another magnetic dipole that absorbs the energy, takes it to the center, and rotates it out at 90 degrees again. So you have this perpetual Mowgli, or constant, endless circulation, or better still, not circulation, propagation of energy. Bearing in mind that in a energy field, E equals mv squared, square of the number of masses, by the velocity squared, it's equivalent to mc squared, because they propagate, the velocity of propagation is the speed of light. So even though we have sheets of paper here in our models, those sheets of paper are moving at the speed of light. They're trying to spread out. Just imagine somebody stretching a rubber sheet with a triangle drawn on it at the speed of light. It goes out in all directions. It tries to do that. All the triangles try to do that within the Higgs field, the Higgs boson, for each charged fascia. But when it does, it propagates up and it hits either another field, another Higgs boson either side or at the base, or it enters the magnetic dipole. And just like applying energy to any inductive coil, which is all the magnetic dipole is electrically, you add energy to it, it increases the field strength, and it then tries to discharge that energy back into the field. So this constant propagation of energy, mass energy momenta, Planck quanta, within the Higgs boson fields or charged fascia of a particle constantly sends electric energy into the magnetic dipole, and the magnetic dipoles convert it back into electrical energy that goes back into the magnetic, goes to the electric, to the magnetic, to the electric, to the magnetic, around and around in these four charged fascia. Now, you might think that if you've got a deuteron or a proton, neutron, etc., that energy might go all around the element in every direction. It doesn't. It's always contained within the tetrion, which is why I emphasized and used the name tetrionics, because the tetrion is the key part. Even though we can build these larger and larger, for example, a quark, by just doing that, say that was a quark, in which case that would be a positive pointing that way. If that was a quark with two positive charges and a neutral tetrion in the middle, even though it's a octahedral topology, eight charged sides that you can see, there's actually 12, it's actually dodecahedral, but four Higgs bosons are hidden, so eight sides are expressed. Even though there's eight sides expressed, the mass energy doesn't circulate through all eight sides. It's only ever circulating within three sets of four. So within each tetrion, the energy is racing around at the speed of light, around and around and around endlessly. It never varies. Once you create a specific particle with a specific rest mass energy, that mass rest mass energy never, ever, 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 ever changes. The only way you could ever change that mass energy is to destroy it and release the mass energies back out as light and heat. And coincidentally, bosons are normally associated with heat, spectral colors. Photons are light. Just a side issue. Once that particle's created, it might as well be a solid lump of aluminium. Oh, sorry, it won't be a solid lump. My mistake. It's got a hollow core, remember. So even though we have this aluminium model here that you can see and I've built, were I to get the weak force to relax on the particle to give up its bonds, what would happen is what you can see here. We could then peer inside the particle, and as you can see, there's absolutely nothing inside. So the mass energies of the particle are contained on its surface. They are its surface. There is nothing inside a particle of matter. Now, that's not the same as what they say in the physics textbooks, where they say atoms are mostly empty space. It's a different way. It's the same statement works. This is English for you in physics. A tetrion is mostly empty space, as you can see. It's four triangles with a empty core. The four triangles form the skin, or the canvas, as I often call it, with charge creating the scaffolding. Charge brings the particles together and the fields together the right way around to form the matter particle. There's nothing inside the matter particle itself. So when you have a quark or a baryon, you have endless numbers of these null spaces. And that's why I say they play an important role in gravity. We won't discuss that now. But it's important to realize that even though what looks like a solid tetrion in my hand here is the basis of the building blocks of matter, they are far from solid. They are, in fact, empty, just like a mailbox. Looks nice and solid from a distance, but it opens up and it's completely empty inside to put things inside it. Nothing goes inside a tetrion, because the only thing that could possibly go inside would be the mass energy when it's created, but they radiate. They move outwards, and they end up being absorbed into the Higgs boson, the charged fascia, or pass right through. Once that matter particle's created, it never changes. The best way to describe that for physicists is to say that the mass energy of a matter topology is Lorentz invariant to changes of velocity. Now, having said that, I know what the physicists are going to say, but we measure changes of mass energy to particles all the time in accelerators. Because when we accelerate them, they get heavier. It's the basis of relativity. Move something faster up to the speed of light, it gets heavier. And that is exactly what happens, but not for the reasons they say or think. Having said that, the mass energy of a matter particle is stored in its field geometry, its charged field geometries, the Higgs bosons. What then explains this additional mass when a particle is accelerated? Simple. When you apply a force to any object, F equals ma, you're applying energy to the system, or adding energy to the particle. That force is just the square root linear momentum. Acceleration is changes of linear momentum to a system. But every linear momentum, as we just discussed, is the square root of a scalar or an equilateral scalar field. So you have to apply scalar electromagnetic energies to create the equilateral geometry of the field that has the linear momentum, the square root linear momentum. So what's really going on? What we're doing, in effect, and I'll use the bigger model so that hopefully you can see it, is remember we have a particle here. It doesn't matter which one you used out of the ones we've discussed. Probably the best one's the one with the linear momentum circulating around. But you could use the transverse model with the quantum levels. Makes no difference. If you apply a force to that particle, you're applying a vector linear momentum. You're applying the force in a vector direction to that particle. That then adds energy to that particle. The energy it adds is not stored in the particle or on the particle itself, on its matter topology. We've already said that that's invariant to changes. So once it's created, you have this particle and that's it. It never changes. So when you apply your force to the particle, give it a push, add a bit of energy, the energy you add forms a secondary field, what I call a chem field, a kinetic EM field. like all energy fields, it's an equilateral geometry. Doesn't matter whether you measure it as transverse bosons within that scalar field of equilateral energies, or whether you measure it longitudinally from top to bottom within that equilateral scalar field, makes no difference. Again, it's still a field that must be created in a certain way. It's created with an equilateral geometry because it's made up of equilateral Planck quanta. And it's simply, for lack of a better word, it's attached or associated to the particle that you're pushing. So the energy, as you can see me here, I'm pushing the particle with my hand, and that's creating a secondary chem field around the particle. The field is equilateral, as we said. It will have a charge associated with it. That charge will always reflect the net charge of the particle. So in this case, we've got a positive charge particle, positive tetrion, so it will be a positive charge distribution, or a distribution of positive, an asymmetric distribution of charges to create a positive chem field. So the chem field charge distributions of Planck quanta always reflects the net charge of the particle. But the real key here is you can think of the particle as a person, and you can think of the chem field as a surfboard, with the vacuum energies, the ether, as the ocean. You apply a force which gives or creates a chem field with a given amount of energy whose square root linear momentum causes the previously stationary or rest particle to move in a specific vector direction. The vector direction is determined by the direction of the linear momentum forms within the chem field. It's as simple as that. In this one, we've got three because I'm cheating. Normally, that chem field will be color-coded all the way down to red at the bottoms, and there'd be a double spectral red to violet back to red to brown back to brown again for the 20 in this one here, but I've just quickly created it. So you've got a median bisector of linear momentum. You've got a bell curve distribution of energies, and that bell curve distribution, the Gaussian / normal distribution that I spoke about earlier, that's the basis of statistics. That's where probabilities come in. What's the probability of finding the particle? What's the highest probability of finding the particle within this energy system, this mass energy matter, the physical system? We've got a particle, we've got its energies of motion. Where's that particle likely to lie? Statistically, it's going to be where the energy content is the most. The most energy is in the particle itself. It's sitting in the center of the chem field. The chem field's energies even peak at the linear momentum. So you can have a bell curve, statistically speaking, the highest probability of finding the particle in this system in motion is right here in the center of the bell curve distribution. The least amount of energies, the lowest energy level of the system, is out here on the edges, far sides, the red color coding, left and right. And in fact, the really stunning thing about this is had I drawn this with this top bit here, with the linear momentum as an electric field, either in this case positive electric field with a linear momentum, and these side quarters as a north field and a south field, you then have an explanation for the magnetic moment of a particle. Because as you add the energy to create this field, this secondary chem field, you not only create a vector direction of motion with kinetic energies and linear momentum, but you've also created a magnetic dipole moment in the particle that didn't exist before. In the original structure of the positive tetrion, you had a four electric fields with four north-south magnetic dipoles on each, in each Higgs boson. When you build that structure, and I should have one here somewhere, maybe not, but when you build that using the other templates that, that we've got on the website, you will note that the north and south magnetic dipoles of those Higgs bosons cancel out. Well, they don't cancel, but they neutralize. They all pair up, north with south, north with south, north with south. So that if you try to measure the magnetic dipole of a positive or negative charge tetrion from our viewpoint in the universe, you can't detect any magnetic field on it. It seems to be a 4π charge topology where it's all positive or negative charge. There doesn't seem to be a magnetic field at all, when in fact there is. It's hidden or neutralized or cancelled, however you want to term it. It's still there, but it's if you try to detect it, and how do you detect it? You bring a north or south magnetic pole from a magnet towards the particle. If you bring a south towards any Higgs fascia, Higgs boson fascia or charge fascia, say you bring the south in, the north will be attracted, but the south will be repelled. So you'll get no motion. You bring in a north pole, the north is repelled, the south is attracted, so you get no motion. The dipoles prevent measurement by a polar detector. So from a physical viewpoint, a field, a particle that's made up of Higgs bosons with electromagnetic fields and electromagnetic quanta appears to be a pure charge particle when it's at rest. So sitting there, it doesn't matter whether you're talking electron or a negative tetrion, the particle is sitting there at rest, and build the model of the electron if you don't believe me, same thing happens, despite a vastly different topology, I might add. You measure it and you just see what's called an electrostatic point particle. You see this point of electric charge with no magnetic field at all. The moment that particle is in motion, what used to be a purely electric field or electric particle suddenly develops a magnetic moment. It has a dipole, a north and south dipole, which has a magnetic vector pointing from south to north within the dipole. And that's the basis. That's the basis of special relativity. But it's a completely different explanation. Special relativity would have you believe that these tetrahedral topologies are spheres. That's why there's no magnetic dipole, because you ask them, they'll say that the spherical surface, the surface area, is all electric charge. There's no magnetic dipole. So where's the magnetic dipole come from, Herr Einstein? It comes from when you move the particle. He borrowed Lorentz contractions, which were developed to explain the Michelson-Morley experiment, or the null effect of the Michelson-Morley experiment. They were developed by Lorentz Abraham to account for why the null effect showed up. They simply said that depending on the direction of motion, the wave expanded or contracted, and that creates red and blue shifts. It creates a null effect with respect to motion in an ether. Einstein said, no, I'll borrow that, and what I'll say is that these spherical shapes, which we've proven don't exist, the spherical point particles, when they move, get distorted or squashed like a ball hitting, being pushed up against the wall. The more you push, the more obligated the ball is, the more it's stretched out sideways. Stretching that ball out sideways as you push it more and more against the wall, there again, assuming that there is a wall, Einstein would argue that there wasn't, but the Lorentz contractions say the faster you go, the more this distortion is created. That distortion, the oblong shape, is in fact somehow the magnetic moment. It changes the electric field into a magnetic field because it's squashed out of shape a little bit. Well, we've shown that the spherical point particles don't exist. We've explained charge. We've explained inertial mass without having to necessarily introduce a Higgs boson, but we can make use of the name. We've explained the shape and how the weak force forms matter from mass energies. And we've explained the strong force that holds tetrions together. We've also explained how mass energy circulates endlessly in these tetrahedral shapes to give us the solid rigidity, the actual materialness of matter. It's physically there. It's a solid shape, just like building these out of wood, except we're using mass energy. We've explained that there is nothing inside these things, that the mass energy is in fact the skin of these particles. And again, particles is only used in reference to matter, 3D matter. You can't have a photon particle because photons are geometries. So, and you can't have a massless photon because all photons have energy, and energy in a temporal measurement, or a temporal measurement of energy per second, or divided by C squared, or the impedance of energy moving through a region, E divided by C squared is mass. Using the word massless particle for a photon, to paraphrase another famous scientist, is so wrong it's not even right. It's not massless. It's not a particle. It is a field of mass, energy, momentum. Which brings us to the final part of this discussion, the one thing we haven't done yet. We've differentiated between mass as planar geometries and matter as a charged topology. What we haven't done is explained the relationship between mass and energy, because going back again to the photon, if this was a photon of energy of that has mass, it's a mass geometry. It has, as we've already said, it has a linear momentum associated with it. Just fold that over so it's clear to see in the field structures here. If you just fold that over, you can see that a photon is two bosons back to back, which means, if you think about it, the energy momenta, energy is the equilateral field, momenta is the square root, pink arrow. The energy momenta of the photon travels in two directions at once from its source. So it's created in the center and it radiates out that way and that way. It has an electric field, two electric fields, and two magnetic fields. These magnetic fields are called a Evans photomagneton dipole moment, I think, or something to that effect. Big fancy word that just says the photon has a magnet, is a bar magnet, a quantum one. The other thing is that the inductive masses of the photon have the momenta, of course, because they have their inductive loops, a positive and a negative. Two inductors back to back electrically form a transformer. So just as you can describe a boson as a quantum inductive loop, you can describe the photon as a quantum inductive transformer. The energy on either side of the inductive wind, the coupled inductive windings, is equal. It's identical in both cases, save a 180 degree phase change, which is exactly what you find. You have a positive charge one end, one radiating one way, and a negative charge radiating the other, which are just bosons. So when people say that we're made up of photons, we're not. We're made up of bosons. We're made up of photons that are made up of bosons. Bosons are the constituents, and the very building block is a Planck quantum. Of course, like any other transformer, we can arrange the windings in a couple of different ways. We can have in-phase or out-of-phase windings. So you could have a, as I said, a positive and a negative charge radiating out, a neutral photon with an electromagnetic field and a magnetic dipole. Or if you change it to two positives like I'm holding, or two negatives, you then have exactly the same thing, except you instead of a neutral charge quantum, you have a charged quantum of light. In this case, it's an electrostatic quantum. It's a quantum of a positive charge field, or it might be a negative charge field. But there again, because we've got two same charges back to back, the magnetic dipole disappears. So where you see an electrostatic field, the magnetic dipoles cancel out and can't be detected. Where you don't see the electric fields, i.e. you have a neutral photon, you have a magnetic moment. The magnetic moment can be detected because you can pass light through extreme magnetic fields, and the photon's polarity will twist, will change. The photon will bend. It bends because it's just like a surfboard. It's subject to a force either side of this geometry, and it bends like a surfboard. Or in the case of a boson, it acts, a boson, say a chem field with a particle, that chem field in motion moving along in a magnetic field, the magnetic wings, so to speak, of that delta chem field, when it encounters a magnetic field, will cause it to bank left or right, just like a plane does when a downdraft hits one wing. You can think of particles in motion, and I often do, as tiny little delta aeroplanes. And whether they go, if you push them, they go faster, like pushing, like turning on the jet engines, or if you want it to change, you just bank it. And how do you bank it? You apply a magnetic field outside of it, left or right. It just banks. And that's the basis of the motion in synchrotrons, etc. And within the particle detectors themselves, as I started earlier, where we detect them by how much they bend. It's the chem field that's causing the bending. Because the positive or negative charge particle that's being accelerated in the chem field hasn't changed. It's still a negative or positive electrostatic particle. It has no magnetic, it has magnetic fields, but they will attract and repel equally to any external field that's applied. So it's not the particle that's being attracted or repelled as it moves through the magnetic field. It's the chem field, the delta wings with the engine at the front and the magnetic, the north and south magnetic wing tips, they cause the reaction to make it bend one direction or the other, because they are just a single dipole. They're not neutralized, so they will react, and they're spaced out. Spatially, they're further out from the particle than the particle itself. So they act like levers, like a lever, to amplify the twisting or the torque force. So all those things are there. The final thing, just to summarize this, to fill this up and to complete it, is that we'll just cover how to differentiate, and this is an important point, how to differentiate between mass and energy in tetrionics. And it's very simple. Again, it comes back down to geometry. We've already seen how Planck quanta make up the equilateral fields, and Planck quanta per second is, Planck quanta have a unit, SI units of joule seconds. So Planck quanta per second, joules seconds per second, is just joules. So it's a measurement of energy. The number of quanta in a system per second or per unit of time is energy. We know now that we have, where we have energy, it's an equilateral field. So any equilateral field has an associated square root linear momentum. So you can, as soon as you say energy, you know you can say momentum. Energy, momentum, hand-in-hand, geometric, geometrically intertwined. The moment you have any quantum adding to it, doesn't matter if it's 1 or 200 trillion, they will form an equilateral field or a diamond field, either one of which has a square root linear momentum produced by its physical geometry, which is its angular momentum. So the linear momentum is the pink arrow splitting the triangles down the middle. The quantized angular momentum is in fact the equilateral geometry. What's its units? Square meters per second. What have we shown that a square is quantum theory or in tetrionics? A square is in fact an equilateral geometry. So quantized angular momentum, what they normally call spin or curl or flux at the quantum level, is not a vector rotation about a point. It's not a physical movement. It is in fact a physical equilateral geometry. So just so you've got that point clear, energy momentum is the linear momentum, the pink bisector. Energy momenta is the equilateral geometry. And if you think about it, Planck's constant is kilograms square meters per second, which is the same as mass quantized angular momentum, or mass omega as I term it. So instead of writing H, you should write mass omega. And that's in fact what tetrionics does throughout all the equations. You see the mass omega there all the time. Why? Because the omega just says that it's an equilateral geometry. It's one of these things that the mathematics has shown since Planck's constant was first devised. They've known that it's got the units of kilograms square meters per second, or mass omega, but their wrong idea of omega being a vector rotation and not an equilateral geometry, because again the word squared does not lend itself to an equilateral shape, has caused probably best part of a century of stagnation. But now that we've made that connection with tetrionics, we've gained back that ground. So where you see energy momenta, you think Planck constant. Simple as that, because it's mass omega. If you see energy momentum, you think equilateral triangle with a line in the center from the apex to the middle of the base. That creates energy momentum, creates the vector force. Energy momenta creates the equilateral geometry that creates the skin of matter. How do we differentiate between energy and mass in tetrionics? Very, very simply. Energy is the equilateral geometry. It's the number of equilateral quanta in any equilateral field that then goes on to make chem fields and EM fields and particles. Mass is a measure of energy per second. Now, in tetrionics, we measure things in light seconds. So one light second, as I said, light radiates in two directions at once. So a beam of light in 1 second will form, if it was a laser beam, for example, radiating in two directions at once, would form a line after 1 second that would create the diameter of a circle, pi r squared, or in this case, pi c squared. So if you want to quickly say, ignoring pi, if you just want to say how far can light travel in 1 second, it can travel in 1 second a distance that's equivalent to a surface area of c squared, a circular c squared in this case, because it can radiate in any direction. So So there might be multiple beams. They all radiate from a point and go out 299,792,558 meters in either direction. So, in which case they would form a circle with a diameter of, you might as well say, 600 million meters, or a radius of 300 million meters, rounding things off. So, energy per light second, or a measure of energy per light second, equates to E divided by C squared. E divided by C squared equals mass. It, of course, also gives us Einstein's formula, E equals mc squared, just by algebraically reworking the formulation, the equation, you get E equals mc squared, which is mass energy equivalence. So mass is a measure of energy per second, or divided by c squared. Energy equals m by c squared. What's that saying? Well, it's saying if you have a known amount of mass in a spatial coordinate system, or a region of space, a given region of space, the mass in that spatial region is equivalent to an energy, or amount of energy. There is no, there's a common misconception where if people explain Einstein's equivalence formulation, they say mass is another form of energy. It's not. It is exactly the same thing. All we're doing geometrically is drawing a line around it. And we're saying that circle that we've drawn around this region of space is what we're measuring. It's our spatial region of measurement, C squared. The energy per C squared is the mass. If you were to just talk about the energy, you wouldn't have that circle, because you have no time units. So you're just saying, this is the amount of energy. This energy can do work. It has an electric component and a magnetic component. It can have a quantized angular momentum, which is the geometry, or it can have a linear component to do work, force over a distance. That's the linear momentum, the square root of all these triangles in space. But you can't measure the work until you have a measurement of time or distance. And in order to measure time or distance, you need to create a coordinate system, a measurement system. Physics uses the speed of light on the base, on the thought that the speed of light is the maximum speed, and it doesn't change unless you're going into a different medium. So in a vacuum, it's always the speed of light in a vacuum. It's a different value if it's the speed of light in water. But that's beside the point. We could have easily, instead of having C squared, we could have had Usain Bolt squared as our spatial coordinate system. And it would have been E divided by Usain Bolt squared, or the distance that he runs in 1 second. The distance that Usain Bolt covers in 1 second is the radius. If he ran in two directions at once, if there's two of them, that would be the diameter, and you draw a circle based on that diameter or the radius. And the physics you're measuring is within that circle. So if you had a number of energy triangles, it's just a mix of triangles. You throw them into the circle and measure them. You then have a measure of mass. They are exactly the same thing. They haven't changed. What's changed is how we're measuring them. And in particular, we measure things in terms of mass because we want to know about their inertial mass, their reaction to forces, to acceleration. We want to know about their gravitational mass, which, funny enough, is equivalent to the inertial mass. It's always the same thing. Again, another discussion point for another topic some other time, but tetrionics shows why that is the case. So to cap off this discussion, we now know that energy is just a case of counting how many triangles without any reference to what they're doing over any period of time, how they're interacting, how they're moving. Nothing. Time stands still. There is no time measurement for energy. But the moment you go to measure a system with energy in it, it is best to call it a measure of mass. You can still call it energy momenta per second, but saying mass momenta is a bit misleading. But these definitions resolve the problems that we have with the mathematical equations of relativity for photons. Because remember, we don't have massless particles of photons anymore. They're gone. We've shown that photons have energy momenta, be it the linear momentum or the geometry, the triangle made up of two equilateral triangles, the diamond, sorry, made up of two equilateral triangles. So energy momenta. And we show that because we're measuring light over a period of time, it's a measure of mass, which explains the relationship of mass to velocity to give us linear momentum. If you try and do that using relativistic formulations, every physicist comes unstuck because they insist that photons move at the speed of light because they're massless. They have no mass. So they always travel at the speed of light. We've now shown that to be a complete misinterpretation and extremely poor definition and differentiation of mass from matter. And in fact, mass from matter from energy in that case, because we've mixed up energy with momentum, with momenta. And we still use the same formulation, the classical formulations, as well as relativistic, and become hopelessly bogged down in being unable to explain it. Once you have the geometries, the equilateral geometries of energy, and you show that those equilateral geometries per second give us mass, and that can be related back to the momentum of a particle, and it's the momentum gives us all the shapes that we've just held up and moved around, we can then use that mass, energy, momenta of a field and allow it to interact via its electric and magnetic fields to create what I call a standing wave topology. It's not technically how most physicists would call a standing wave. I understand that and I acknowledge that, but I call it that because it's standing still. And if you could actually view this wave with the energies still circulating, it is still technically a standing wave. The energies are still in motion at the speed of light, but the particle that these mass energies are within does not move. So you've got this perpetual mobility, as you say, Otto, where the energies are spinning around at the speed of light, furiously becoming electric, becoming magnetic, becoming electric, becoming magnetic, from one end of the one side of the tetrahedra to the other fascia, back to the other, spinning around and around and around constantly. But to us, it's a solid piece of matter. But it's the topology, the charge topology, with its closed volume that makes it matter, gives it the solidity that mass energy does not have. Mass energy can still affect the force. It is. Those mass energies and the momenta is what force is all about. But it's immaterial because it's a geometry. You can't touch it, feel it, taste it. You can feel it given enough energies. Electricity will throw you off your feet, will burn you. You can see light, but it's intangible. You can wave your hand through a beam of light. You can wave your hand through electricity if you're quick enough, depending on how high the voltage is and how fast it is frequency-wise. But when it comes to material matter, whose skin is just mass energies, the very same thing that was immaterial becomes material. So the differences are geometric. The definitions are now provided by tetrionics that are clearly missing in the mathematical approach to physics. But where tetrionics, where it really steps up above even the geometry, is when we color code it, as we've done here. And you can see left to right are bosons, odd number quantas, which sum up to scalar energy fields, which can be read top to bottom longitudinally to give us photons of energy momenta. You can see all these properties emerge from the simple tessellation or addition of countless equilateral triangles of energy momenta. And of course, when I say energy momenta, I mean equilateral plane quanta. That's the definition of energy momenta. The energy momentum gives us the force of Newtonian mechanics. The addition of all these geometries, the energy momenta, side by side, combining them like a pattern in a tapestry or a jigsaw puzzle, is what gives us quantum mechanics. And the final point is that, as per those illustrations, you'll see two illustrations there, numbered, doesn't matter whether you look at 1 and 3 or 2 and 4, you see that when you add X amount of energy to a system, because there's no time measurement, you're just adding countless numbers of identical Planck triangles, save their charges. They might be mixed up, but they're exactly the same size. They are all identical size triangles over and over and over. That's adding energy to a system. When you add mass to a system, the energy is constrained within that circle we spoke of. So you've drawn a circle. Say, for example, the circle was the size of your fingers forming a circle. You could pick up 25 million triangles, throw them down on a desk or on the ground, and start joining them together, or even leave them scattered. The 25 million triangles will form a larger triangle. It might be the size of a basketball court. But all those triangles will be exactly the same size. That's what happens when you geometrically add energy to a region of space. There's no time measurement. You're just adding X amount of triangles that are all identical together to form a larger triangle. However, when you do that, you add that same energy to a circle, like I said, with your fingers forming a circle, those same 25 million triangles are added, but they form a triangle within that circle. So the triangle that they form is smaller than the basketball court sized one that formed from just energy being added. And in this case, this is where relativity is finally explained, or Lorentz contraction. The energy field is constrained within the spatial coordinate, the circle. And you see that everywhere. Wherever there's a triangle with a circle around it, that's us measuring the system. Energy per second, as I've said, is mass. But in order to fit those 25 million triangles of energy into that circle, into the one triangle within the circle, obviously the triangles themselves have to be made smaller. And that's what you see in those illustrations, 1 and 3 or 2 and 4. The 1 and 3, both are energies. So as you add the energy, the triangles get the main triangle gets bigger. The resultant triangle gets bigger. In illustrations 2 and 4, because we're constrained by the circle, the time measurement, C squared, the field can only get so big. And then all those same triangles have to fit inside it. And in doing so, you're squeezing them in. They become smaller. And you can see that as each field gets more and more energy, the quanta gets smaller. How do we say, what's the term for that? It's called a Lorentz contraction. the physical size of the Planck quanta themselves becomes smaller as the energy increases. This is normally expressed in other fields as the relationship of, as you increase the frequency of a field of energy, the wavelength decreases. In relativity, because they haven't understood it properly through these geometric terms, you'll often hear the terms length contraction due to velocity. As something speeds up, it gets shorter and shorter and shorter. The often used analogy is that a railway locomotive traveling at half the speed of light is an inch shorter than what it was traveling at 60 mile an hour. It gets physically shorter. That Lorentz contraction is part of that squashing the sphere to make the magnetic moment. This is relativity trying to explain things, and then the explanation becoming more and more cumbersome and unwieldy as physics evolves. None of that is happening. Where you see length contraction in relativity theory, think wavelength. The only thing that's changing when you're measuring mass, remember mass is the same as energy, it's the same thing, and there's no difference. The only difference is in mass terms, the wavelength of the Planck quanta, the mass omega, the wavelength, the physical size of the mass omega is becoming smaller as you increase the energy, i.e. its wavelength is contracting. So you'll see that in my work where you see Lorentz contractions. I always make a point of pointing it out. It's not length contraction, it's wavelength contraction. Because again, the fields, remember how I said matter, the mass energy content of matter, once it's created, never changes. It's always moving at the speed of light, even if the particle's stationary. It doesn't change. You pick that particle up, it's the same physical size, whether you're at rest or whether you're traveling at the speed of light or 10 times the speed of light. The size of the particle never, ever changes. Its mass energy content never, ever changes. What changes? The mass energies in the chem field. Remember, a force applied to a material particle creates the chem field. The larger the force, the more energy is put into that field. Remember, this energy field is constrained because we're measuring a physical system with units of time. So we've got a circle around this chem field. Even though we're adding energy, a nondescript number of quanta via a force, an applied force, once we add it to the particle and we're measuring that particle over some period of time, we've drawn a circle around the chem field, so we're no longer technically measuring energy. We're measuring the mass and energy momenta equivalence of that field. And as we increase the frequency or add more energy quanta to the field, apply more force, the wavelength, the physical size of those Planck quanta of energy momenta, the size of the triangles, has to decrease. They have to get smaller to fit within that C squared temporal or spatial field, spatial coordinate system. So if you were not to measure that, if you just wanted a snapshot of that system and you didn't care what direction it was moving or what changes occurred, you just wanted just like the tetrionic models, you wanted a static photo of that system, then you could turn that you're measuring the energy of the system. And that's what relativity does. It takes a snapshot of the system, says incorrectly, it says we have matter and mass in that system. We'll use E equals mc squared for both the mass of the chem field and the matter of the particle, and will convert all of that into energy, which is called the stress energy tensor. But in doing that, they no longer can differentiate between the matter particle and the chem field. So when the particle accelerates, they say this nebulous energy that we've created in the stress energy, even though it's no longer a particle, gets Lorentz contracted. The wavelength changes. The mass of the system increases. And the mass does increase. But it's only the mass of the chem field that's increasing. The mass of the particle is exactly the same as it was when it was at rest. Relativity, by using stress energy tensors, was able to give us some advances, but in doing so, it hopelessly clouded the real physics going on. Tetrionic strips it all back, which is what this discussion was all about, into, by defining mass, energy, and matter, and differentiating between mass, energy, and matter geometrically, we can now explain all these properties, these basic physical properties, inertial mass, charge, the geometry of particles, their mass energy, their momentum. Why, when you crash two particles, do you get a release of light? How can you make an electron and a positron out of two light beams coming together, two gamma rays? All these things can now be explained both mathematically and geometrically in tetrionics. But more importantly, the geometry allows us to correct the math and the assumptions that have been drawn from the math. And there's quite a few of them. It doesn't go down well with the mathematicians and the physicists presently, obviously, because they've grown used to their model of spherical particles and energy as being nebulous and not real and things like that. But as you can see from the discussion tonight, it's not nebulous. It can be if you measure it incorrectly and poorly define and differentiate between them. But if you take the basic, the foundational postulate of tetrionics, which is that the squared numbers of physics are in fact equilateral geometries, then you can see what we've just brought up here tonight, how we've measured these fields in all different directions, how we've defined what a field is versus what a particle is, photons and bosons versus fermions. All those things are explained. We've even explained the Higgs boson, not only visually, but we've explained what it is. It's a charged fascia in every one of the charged fascias in every matter topology. And it's comprised of mass, energy, momenta, and momentum. The current model of physics can't even do that. They know that the Higgs boson is there. Ask any physics teacher to explain the actual mechanics of the Higgs boson, and they'll probably go back to this celebrity idea or moving bigger particles through molasses or something. And here's the final point, the very final point. This is what you can draw from this that'll really spin your head. A particle two particles in the same family, let's say leptons, because they're a good example. You can have positrons and electrons, identical in mass, energy, and weight, identical matter topologies, but they have opposite charges. The positron is made up of 12 positive Higgs bosons. The electron is made up of 12 negative charge Higgs bosons. There again, physics doesn't even realize that the Higgs bosons is charged. But that aside, we also have another lepton in that family. It's the neutrino. The neutrino isn't positive or negative. It is neutral. It is comprised of 6 positive and 6 negative Higgs bosons, an equal number, which gives you no electric charge. It's also different to electrons and positrons in the fact that it is one of the lightest particles in existence. So light that they haven't even found a way to measure it and determine its exact mass at the moment. Tetrion can tell you what its existence is because it's got 12 charged fascia, and the minimum amount of quanta in a fascia is one Planck quantum. So you, from that, you could say, can say, that the neutrino has 12 Planck quantum making up its charged topology, or the 12 Higgs bosons are single Planck quanta. So if you take to calculate the mass of a neutrino, you just have to go 12 times the mass of a Planck quantum, which gives you a value of 8.85 by 10 to the minus 50 kilograms. That's an exact rest mass for a neutrino. If you move the neutrino or apply a force or add energies of motion, the mass energies increase and it changes. It becomes a different flavor of neutrino. It becomes a muon neutrino or a tau neutrino by speeding it up. Remembering again that the physical size of the particle hasn't changed. That's right. A neutrino is exactly the same size as an electron, which is the same size as a positron. All that's changed, and it makes sense if you think about it because they're all leptons, all that's changed is the charge arrangement, the positive and negative Higgs bosons that form the actual matter topology, and the number of Planck quanta in those Higgs bosons, the amount of mass in the field. So if a neutrino is the lightest particle, you can only have 12 Planck quanta making it up. It's the simplest thing, bar a tetrion, that you can make. It's three neutral tetrions joined together. And that's why they're made so commonly in stars, because it's just positive and negative charges. Four of them come together, form a tetrion, and three tetrions come together to form the neutrino. It is the simplest, lightest particle possible. Or standard model particle, put it that way, possible. The tetrion's the lightest, but the neutrino is only three times heavier. But what's the differential between the neutrino and the positron-electron pair? The differential in mass for exactly the same size particle is that the positron-electron pairs, instead of one Planck quanta per fascia, have 1 by 10 to the 19 Planck quanta per fascia. Way more energy in each face, which makes them far more solid, a lot more inertial mass, and obviously a lot heavier. And they have a charge, 12 positive and 12 negative, compared to the neutral charge of the neutrino. But there again, tetrionics now gives us a model where we know the size of the neutrino. It's exactly the same size as the electron. We now understand how that can be the case, because if you look at all the textbooks, if you have a picture of an electron and a neutrino side by side, I guarantee you the neutrino will be the dot on the page, and the electron, if drawn to scale, will be a basketball. There's always this size differential. It's lighter, so it must be smaller. That's not the case, because weight and mass is just a measure of energy. Mass is a measure of energy in a spatial region, whether it's loose energy or whether it's in a charged fascia, makes no difference in a matter topology. And weight is just the measure of that mass energy in a matter topology in a gravitational field. They're all tied together. But the thing to take away from this final point is that just because a particle is lighter does not mean it's smaller. And just because a particle's heavier does not mean that it's bigger. an electron moving at near the speed of light, or say a positron moving at near the speed of light, will have the identical charge and the same momenta as a proton moving at a slower velocity, because all the mass, all the energy is stored as mass, Lorentz contracted mass, wavelength contracted, squeezed in, mass, in the chem field. The chem field points out in the direction of motion like a delta wing with a very sharp knife edge, and it slices through, dragging the particle along with it. Of course, the particle offers resistance to the environment that it's in, will gain, inertially reacts because of the inertial mass and energy content of its charged fascia, and that slows down, that uses up energy. That inertial resistance to motion uses up energy, requires energy. If you're no longer applying energy to the system, the energy has to be bled out of the chem field. As you take the energy out, the Planck quanta reduce, their wavelengths get larger, the Lorentz contraction is reversed, and the wavelengths become longer and longer and longer, to the point where you're left with one or no Planck quanta, at which point the particle no longer has any forward motion in any direction. Of course, if you apply three or four forces, say you apply three forces on three of the four sides of a tetrahedra, you would generate three chem fields pointing in three different vector directions, and the amount of energy momenta in those chem fields is proportional to the force applied in each direction. But the particle will move in the direction that is the vector sum of those three vectors. So just like you did in high school, you take the three vectors and you do the vector algebra on it, and you work out the final vector, and that's the direction they move. And then depending on the inertial resistance of each charged fascia to the direction of motion, the chem fields will dissipate over time, and that's what we describe as friction or inertial mass, the slowing down, which was one of the big takeaways of Renaissance physics. I mean, like, as we started to develop, and we, one of the laws of motion, an object in motion stays in motion unless it's acted upon by an external force. If there was no inertial mass or no field, if there was no ether to react with the inertial charged fascias of the matter topology, that particle would continue in its vector direction forever, because it had never had the energy in it, would never change. But there are vacuum energies, there is air resistance, etc., and the inertial resistance to vacuum energies and the ether is exactly the same as the wind resistance or air resistance to a particle or an object moving through an atmosphere. Exactly the same, just a different scale of interaction. So all these things come back together and come back out of these energy quanta, these triangles. If you try and develop the same ideas and understanding using spherical energy quanta or hexagonal energy quanta or smoky little halos of energy, you can't do what tetrionics does. And tetrionics doesn't stop here, obviously, as we now know. We carry this through to electrodynamics, electrical engineering, chemistry, biology, cosmology. It's been applied in a wide variety, and at the core of it is this Planck geometry, and throughout it all, to keep a coherent, consistent theory, the geometry sets the grammar. The mathematics is followed wherever possible, where it is wrong and shown to be wrong, the explanation for that, for the incorrectness is revealed, and the correct formulation is given, like I've done tonight with H nu squared, etc. And that's where I'll pull it up for you, Otto. I think we've given that a good sound rounding out. Any questions?
In a way, lots of them, yes. But this is first I have to digest a bit what you've done in connecting tetrions with electromagnetic fields. Also by reframing our whole understanding of how we are looking at what we see, determining what we are seeing. And I will have a question, one question which came up right when you started already, but that will be a separate session, would be about the relationship between the tetrion and the quantum. Because you've already illustrated that the quantum, which is the fundamental unit, the minimal measure of time and space and energy in physics as it has been presented, is in fact very dependent on the way we look at it. And with what you just described, I saw that I have to eliminate a perspective bias which I got with my training in physics and engineering. And so I would gladly ask you to go into the relationship between space and time and energy from the perspective of the quantum as the fundamental unit of change in the universe. Linking that to how a tetrion can actually be perceived to have more quanta than just one, as I would have imagined.
I would just add quickly that a tetrion is a quantum of matter. The quantum of energy is the boson, the Planck quantum. One's a quantum of mass energy, which is the Planck quantum. The quantum of matter is the tetrion. The tetrion's the physical matter quantum. It's the building block of matter, but it's comprised of Planck quanta. So the very building block of the entire universe is just a triangle with a positive and negative charge either side, a Planck's constant, as it's known. So if you're talking matter, you can say tetrion's the quantum. It's the quantum of matter. But the quantum of everything is Planck's constant, Planck's quantum.
Yeah, so I'd like to unravel some of my misunderstandings at that level, because you've resolved basically the perspective bias on when you look with time and when you look without time. One of the basic understandings in quantum theory is that it operates outside of space and time. It just uses energy as a measure, and as a result, the equations do not work with space and time in that sense. That also was one of the difficulties of connecting it to the theory of relativity, which had time as its measure, and the say the classical physical models, which used space as its measure. And I think that there is a very nice way to resolve all of these conflicts in what you described right at the start, where you said that in the tetrion, you can have these different levels of energies. And so I assume that the unraveling of this difference between classical physics with a measure of space, relativistic physics with the measure of time, the circle in the tetrionic formulation, or the quantum approach outside of time and space, which uses the quantum as the norm, the fundamental unit of change, which in tetrionics is described as the equilateral triangle. So that is something I'd like to pick up in a separate session, because I imagine that would be quite a story in itself.
Tend to be.
Yeah, and then I'd like to come back at what you have just presented, which in a way builds up on that understanding for which I still have my question, which would be that separate session. But then in answering the level beyond that, you show that in looking at matter, there is this relationship between the four quantum charges which form this perpetuum mobile cycle, this eternal form which can replicate itself, shown as the tetrahedron. And that is a very simple logic to the way that and keeps itself going by, as you nicely presented, this interplay between electric, magnetic, and so on. So basically it's like walking on two legs, zigzagging at the edge of reality in this single point, which in physics would be called a tetrion, the soliton, or a hologram, depending on how you look at it.
Yeah, there's lots of terms we can use.
Yeah, yeah.
And have been used. I mean, like over the years, everybody that develops a theory tends to put their own verbiage to things. So it's not uncommon for even Einstein's E equals MC squared was not written as E equals MC squared.
Basically, everyone that's what
will
you
take
did.
It away, and it'll change over time.
You've shown that there is a much simpler way to understand how matter interacts with the EM fields, how the Higgs boson actually is not a particle, but it's the surface charge of the material structural unit. And as a result of that, it will determine the interaction between tetrion with tetrion, but also the interaction between the tetrion and the EM field. And that, of course, is then the basis of chemistry, which will also always be electrochemistry.
Yeah.
And that, of course, is the whole key in tetrionics as well, that we are no longer dealing with physics, but we are always dealing with electrophysics.
Electromagnetic.
Yes.
Yeah.
Electromagnetic physics. So that's essentially also what people often forget, that physics is when people study matter without looking at the electromagnetic aspects of it. Chemistry is when people look at the molecules, where matter does have charges, but there is no further use of those charges. And then atomic physics is where it is seen that physics is actually just a structure of charges. So in the transition from physics to chemistry to atomic physics, there is actually the transition from physics to chemistry to electromagnetism, but it is also the transition from classical to relativistic to quantum modeling. And in tetrions, you go a level deeper because you work with the quantum, and that is what you have now shown basically in two different phases or two different modes of organization. The quanta are organized as fields in which you can look at it from the quantum perspective with the bosons and the transverse waves, or you can look at the longitudinal perspective of it, which is also continuation in time, look at as the photons. And so with the boson, you see that they will always move, they will always have a charge. For the photons, you can see that they will always extend, but always appear as neutral. And you referred that to the difference between symmetry and symmetry break. And also, boson will always have asymmetry because it will be either positive or negative. While the photon will be positive and negative, so thus appear as neutral. So is this session given very, very fundamental consideration of physics, of chemistry, of mathematics, geometry, bring it all back in the foundation of tetrionics. of the interacting memory and matter. But the extreme need to discern between energy and mass and matter and matter. I'd rather round off of this session here for the simple reason that with what you've just put on the table, literally, as these wonderfully colored and very clear images, that really helps to literally get a grasp of what we're trying to understand. Anything that we would pick up at this moment would lead to another very extensive story, because that's basically what you have described in the book of tetrionic chemistry, tetrionic cosmology, what's now going on in tetrionic biology. So we would, whatever small step of questions we would take here would lead to large leaps in exploration of further understanding.
I think you're getting used to that.
Yes.
One plus one equals two equals 14 equals 39, so on and so forth. It's exponential. The connections, the big thing I keep stressing is if you can get your head around these basics in the geometric terms, and it comes through fiddling with the models and wrapping your head around what I say in my work illustrations, but if you can get the basics under control and understand how to differentiate between mass, energy, matter, the role of charge, the rest of it really flows. You don't have to worry so much about the finer detail of the maths, etc., because you'll see those relationships, and that's, as you say, that's where the color coding comes in. It was one thing when I first developed the theory to just have the shapes, but once I color coded them, the information that becomes apparent at a glance is phenomenal. As you can see, transverse versus longitudinal. You can see the momentum. Transverse, you can see the quantum levels. All these things just bound out. And then as your brain gets familiar with it and you can see it visually, you don't tend to worry about the math so much. You know what you're looking for in the math problems, but then you apply the geometry. You look at it and you go, okay, how do we make it? And then using that geometry, you get the answers. And you can see if the math is right and we've misinterpreted it, or whether it's a case of the math was off target in the first place, in which case you then correct and explain the correction. But in all cases, it's the visual side. It's the geometry and the colors that make it work, just like you experience with music. You can show somebody a sheet of music and some people will reinterpret it and play it in their head. Other people like myself will look at the sheet of music and go, so what? Does nothing, explains nothing. But both of those people have the same emotional responses when you play the music. It's the same sort of twist. It's the different aspects of writing music to understanding music to feeling the music. Same thing happens with writing the physics, the equations, understanding the equations geometrically, and seeing the particles in their fields. Same interplays going on, different things, but it's engaging a whole side of the brain that's not normally used for physics. That's the exciting part, because if we can get some more artistic people involved, they will probably see patterns that I've missed. My brain's pretty rigid. I've come up with this wonderful theory, but I've got a very rigid thought process. So sometimes it takes me a while to change my line of thinking to see things. But when you do, that's when you suddenly go, well, if I color code it a different way, I get the normal distribution. Look what I can explain now. There may be another color coding system in that same field arrangement I haven't seen yet. In which case, there'll be more explanations for yet other processes.
Yeah, that essentially is the whole power of tetrionics. It's a tool for rethinking what is known.
Exactly.
it starts with very literally the toolkit of Tetrionics, of cutting out the templates, playing around with them, forming the shapes, and then literally getting a grasp of it by your fingers, translating the connections, your body experiencing the logic. And then once that is in place, for you, everything else fell in place, plus all the confirmations of what physics had been finding, plus all the corrections in how mathematics attempted to describe that. And as you discovered in the physics now as a geometry, the atomic numbers and values and organizations can be seen as at a glance, which of course means that in using Tetrionics as the base of a technology, a lot becomes much simpler, because what now takes still a lot of work using computers becomes a matter of fact easy reflection by looking at what you can build using these models. And so Tetrionics is not a philosophy, not a theory, not a technology. Yes, it is a modeling instrument, but it is also a computational process. It's also an intellectual reflection, and most important, it is a reformulation of how we have been looking at things, as a result of which we can see the simplicity behind all of it. And that, for me, is one of the most important elements of Tetrionics. And I think that the presentation which you did today is at the essence of what I try to describe in the mathematics of involvement. Because it's evident that there are now four forms of physics. Classical, which looked at physical reality, relative physics, which looked at the molecular reality, quantum theory, which looked at the atomic approach of things, and then there's the field theory, looking at the immaterial underlying logic, basically a mathematical perspective. But all of them are differences of involvement. As the alchemist said, you can look at it from a still standpoint, and then you will see everything that's fixed. You can move around and everything will become relativistic. You can actually move to and fro and everything will become probabilistic, like in quantum theory. But you can actually realize that you can jump up, hover around, and then in the air create a somersault or land in a different place, and suddenly you discover that your participation in creation is actually what matters. And that's also what you described today, that relationship between energy, mass and matter, which is all based on the flipping of the charge in the quantum. And that is where we change our involvement. So at that level, you've talked about much more than the foundation of physics and reality. You also addressed the basis of psychology and realization, which for me, of course, is one of the more important aspects of what Tetrionics can offer, because that's not just a bridging between science and religion, but it's also the bridging between subjectivity and objectivity. It brings it down to the zero point, which in our life determines the difference between life and death, or mind and matter. So at that level, what you have addressed today as the change of perspective which you can get from using Tetrionics is also the equivalent to a procedure of healing of what in general we know as science, or by its application technology, or by its effect, the world that we live in. The planetary pollution was caused by the assumption that we were outsiders of the world and it didn't matter what we do. We can create something and throw it away and not have to consider that it will pollute the planet. But in today's story, it is clear that whatever different perspective you take, you will see the tetrion or the quantum as the fundamental unit, or you will see it as something that needs to adapt to a, for example, time-limited perspective. And that's something I still have to elaborate a bit in my mind, because I suddenly realized that the time loop of the circle around the triangle also becomes the time loop as the magnifying glass or the spyglass, as a telescope or microscope, which
change your time.
Yeah, and
time in increments, and you zoom in and out.
Yeah, and specifically,
1 second versus an hour.
Yeah, connecting that to mathematics, if you actually then determine the second as something connected to our perception, which essentially is very often the case, then you can no longer see how it must be based on what the quantum actually is doing. And that is a level of clarity which I saw in what you presented today, that there is something very fundamental about the triangle with the circle, the triangle without the circle. Actually, when you put the circle around it, you flip the model inside out by circling it, and not realizing that circle is actually expanding like the photon does. You don't see that the next step of the circle is actually a larger circle with more triangles in it. So by fixing on the circle, which is actually the moving photon as it expands, it seems as if there are more triangles crouching in on the tetrion. And that is a very important difference in perspective. That's also where relativity theory, which focused on the time basis of physics, was already different from classical theory, which looked at the meter of matter. On the other side of that relativistic view is then the underlying understanding that it is in the quantum that we see the universal unit of change. So in that sense, you've, in what you described, also shown that it's not just the difference between energy, mass, and matter, but it's also the difference between quantum physics, relativistic physics, and classical physics. There are differences of perspective, and once that is clear, and that's something which I now see how I can still clarify that in my mind, in having heard what you said today, but all of the other stories which you told as well, which are not stories but explanations of the experiences that you can get with just playing with the templates of tetrionics. So in that sense, as I said, I need to digest a bit what I just feel sliding in place within me, for the simple reason that in what you talked about today, the bicycle which didn't have any gearbox before suddenly has a gearbox. And I also see that with respect to the tetrahedron with and without multiple charges on the surface, there is a forward gear and a backward gear in the way we can look at things. And that's also where we zoom in and zoom out of reality. And that's where I see that we have this link between reality and realization. That at one level we can see the tetrion as having just one unit of charge, which is the quantum connected to it. And then when we change our involvement, we see that it can flood with unit charges. But at the same time, we must always look at how it is then moving in the space around it. And that's why your description of the tetrion as a hologram is very helpful for anybody looking into physics, because once you see that physics is not material, but it is actually a standing wave, it is, say, a photon folded double on itself, creating a tetrion, then you can see that indeed it is crystallized light. And that whatever that crystallized light appears to do is only as a result of the electromagnetic fields around it. And that is something which many people have not yet come to grasp. They still think that there is a reality in the same way that the classical scientists assumed that reality was fixed. Now we know that it's just an electromagnetic field with little crystalline particles reflecting the electromagnetic fields in it and around it, and that we can no longer look at reality as a thing, but we have to look at realization as a process, which is actually what David Bohm already described long ago, and many others have addressed in similar manners. Schrödinger also realized that we are just an electromagnetic field within the universal electromagnetic field. And in what you described today, now with this very wonderful and very direct coupling of the spectra of light to the tetron, you in a way show how the fascination of matter as atoms and materials and as a reality is just a sparkling mirror in the shape of a little tetron reflecting the electromagnetic fields. So there's so much that comes out of this, but as I said, that is the essence of the book on chemistry. So I would suggest that we round off this recording session, and as usual, I'd like to ask you to conclude that in whichever way you please, and that at some point we can just unravel the further depths and layers all associated with what you've just said. And for me, it would be very helpful if we could just in a way go back one step and look at the details of why the tetron can have one quantum as a starting basis, but also can fill up with all the levels. So that would be something for a next episode, if you will.
Yeah. I mean, like, tonight was just about trying to reinforce how important a role geometry plays as opposed to just a pure mathematical exploration of physics. And of course, the main points were that we can now define and differentiate between mass, energy, and matter far better than we could before, and we can use those definitions to introduce charge geometries and charge topologies, fields and particles, into physics, and they're the building blocks of physics itself. And if you don't get them right, or you can't understand those basics, trying to figure out physical processes without that understanding just becomes problematic, as we're experiencing. We're making huge and massive gains in experimental results and theoretical ideas, but we're doing it in a very scattered, undisciplined approach. And as is shown with tetrionics, it appears that there's a lot of information that can be just outright discarded. It's the old language grammar scenario that I keep bringing up with tetrionics. And tonight was all about showing you how to use the geometry and the paper models to define and differentiate between mass, energy, matter, and introduce charge, an understanding of what charge is, where it comes from, what it really is, and the role it plays in modern physics. Because pick up any textbook, and I guarantee they will not explain the quantum source of charge and the role it plays anything like what we've discussed tonight. And certainly not to the extent that tetrionics can discuss and elaborate on it. It was all about tonight, activating the right-hand side of the brain, showing you that you don't have to sit there analytically learning the mathematical equations and interpreting the mathematical equations, sometimes several times over until you get the same answer as your teacher. It's tetrionics now allows us to intuitively look at these particles, to build them, to look at them, to fiddle with them, to see what flows, because invariably it's the flow of the geometries and the topologies that dictate what's really going on. You can have all sorts of mathematical equations, but if they don't match the physical reality, you've just spent your life developing some ad hoc abstract theory that may never ever apply. And you've got to also remember that relativity is based on a form of geometry that it, for all intents and purposes, looked like it was dead in the water. Nobody could see a use for it until relativity had to describe the forces within EM fields, and then it came into play. But then again, the same mistake was made. What is described as a curved line in space became a geodesic following curved space-time. Both answers are wrong, and yet both have been accepted, when in fact the truth lies in between. The truth is the geometry that gives rise to both of them. Yet another discussion. So hopefully if people can study this one, build the models, play with it, get it going in the creative part of their mind, more so than the analytical, and then slowly merge the two, they'll find tetrionics so much easier going. And they'll find physics, biology and chemistry, cosmology in general, so much easier going. Because they'll end up like I do. It's just like learning another language. You translate the mathematics into the pictures, and the pictures will tell you the results you should get. It's like a Cliff's Notes or a cheat sheet for working at the equations. You apply, you look at what you need to do, you build the model in your mind, you see what the model's doing, and then you say, that's the answer I should be getting. It's very straightforward. So hopefully I've conveyed the basics, and people pick up how to differentiate between the three forms of energy now. We've had other discussions, and no doubt have more discussions on the nuances of mass, energy and matter and their role in physics.
Yes, thank you, Calvin. And I also want to thank you explicitly for not just the presentation which you did and all the explanations which are contained within that, but also the preparations which you did in the new templates that you have added to the collections. Because with those templates, there is that much deeper level of insight which everybody can now basically pick up the fruits of what you have already explored, and basically step in your shoes, which in this case are high-speed boots, to pick up the space of what can be understood with tetrionics. So thank you very much for the work you did on that. Beautiful, as always.
Thanks for prodding me to do it, because, as we know, I've got a lot in my head, and sometimes I need the prodding to put what's in my head down on paper. And it's always a productive exercise, because you then have that resource to use in other examples and other discussions.
Yeah, thank you. So this is a good point to close off the recording for now. As usual, I come back to you to evaluate, and everybody can enjoy what you've just explained. Thanks.
Thank you, Otto.